This episode of the FitCast is brought to you by the PTAdvantage.com, an online personal training solution to help trainers save time and make more money. Hands down the best resource I've found for distance coaching. Check them out at thePTAdvantage.com. Hello and welcome to this episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 282. I am Kevin Larrabee, and continuing the throwback episodes that I seem to be doing, I have Jonathan Fass on the show. John, how you doing?
Hi there.
It's been a long time since we talked.
Right. So welcome back to the old school casting.
Welcome back, Cotter.
Yeah, man.
I've never seen that show in my life.
I grew my afro out. Yeah, I grew my afro out in relationship to the Cotter.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we do have a great show lined up for you today. We got some really cool stuff. And the best part about not having John on the show for a long time is he has a lot of stuff to talk about.
Well, some stuff.
Well, I think it's going to be the case of, well, let's take a step back, because I think it's really interesting that you and Brett, you've gone and you've done a couple episodes of Strength of Evidence, which have been really good. And for people out there that haven't checked it out, I really recommend you go and find it on iTunes. And not only to kind of understand how to understand research, but also to get their interpretations of it. And I can definitely say that I trust Brett and John when it comes to interpreting that stuff, because they've been so deep, like knee deep in research papers forever. Same thing along the lines of Alan Aragon. If you ever read his research review, also good stuff. But I've become more of a fan of digesting things in audio form. So what's the deal with that? Is that still in hiatus, or are you guys taking a break for the summer season, or you're going to be coming back with the fall season premiere?
Yeah. So this will be a major, major announcement in terms of any fans of the show, but it's just going to be me solo moving forwards. I've got a couple things lined up, and I'm just traveling right now. We've got Marianne coming to Saudi, and I'm writing like a couple different things with a couple different people. But when all that settles down, I definitely want to get back into recording, and I have some really interesting, cool interviews coming up that I wanted to take, and not in a different direction, because the purpose of the show is very important to me, but more about exploring kind of what you said about not just, okay, here's a claim, let's analyze it, but more about the entire process of critical thinking and how being more instructive in it, I think, so that people that say, okay, I get it, the research is cool, but how am I supposed to actually do this on a day-to-day basis? How am I supposed to allow this to affect my practice? I want to take things in that direction to show people not just like, okay, this claim is plausible or not, but how would I use that in my continued practice? How can I use this approach in other questions that I might have that come up? So I'm going to purposely take some ideas that maybe don't have as much evidence, or the evidence is mixed, or things of that nature, and really discuss how you apply that as a clinician, because I don't really consider myself a researcher. I just consider myself a clinician that uses research. So I want to explore that idea and explore how using an evidence-based approach is not this sort of limiting process or this negative process that I think gets kind of levied upon the idea, but it's actually a process of exploration, and it's something that's really enjoyable and opens your mind to things rather than closes it off. And so I want to kind of make it more of a celebration of this type of approach, which I believe is the right approach to take in things. So I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Let's start off there, because Lee and I don't know if you got to check out the interviews with Lee the last couple of weeks, but one of the things that we discussed is the interesting kind of community, or the aspect of discussing this stuff on social media like Facebook or on Twitter and things like that. When a new paper comes out, throw it up on Facebook for discussion. I know you've been you've been posting stuff on there. When something comes out, you kind of go through it, you digest it, and then you give your feedback and give your opinion on the piece and, you know, what it means for, you know, us more lay people out there that are just, you know, want to, you know, don't want to get into the research. We depend on you guys to digest it and then feed it back to us. So do you feel like Facebook is a conducive environment for these discussions? Because I know you've had some interesting, you know, back and forth with, you know, Brett Chone specifically in the FMS and discussions on there, because there has been more research that the FMS has been involved with. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the discussion leads into, but the, you know, the researchers weren't using the FMS correctly. The study wasn't set up correctly. You know, maybe this information isn't really valuable to us. It's just kind of waste. So I wonder if you could answer that first question, if you think it's a good environment for these discussions. And then B, I think, you know, since everyone asked for it, let's talk a little bit about the FMS stuff. Again, I want to...
we'll make it brief. I know it's like driving you nuts, but we'll make it brief.
But I want to preface it by saying, you know, I've really come around on a lot of this stuff. And I think one of the big things I really hope you get to see, and I hope that Larry Draper films it, that Gray Cook has done a fantastic job of doing a better job explaining the FMS at seminars and how he uses it. And then also how he programs based on the scores that he gets. So I hope we can, again, I don't think it's, like I mentioned on the thread, I don't think it's super fair to have this discussion without someone like Brett here to do the other side, because I'm not going to fight for the FMS. Right. But I also don't have anything against the FMS. I think it's, you know, a good place for a lot of people to start, you know, at least to get the ball rolling if you're not very good with screening or just getting into this field. So, yeah, I just threw a lot at you. I hope you get a bunch of air and, yeah, get a drink of water, and then let's hear it.
I made my AeroPress coffee. That is a plug for the AeroPress. If anyone – did you get yours yet?
AeroPress? No, you talked to me about that. I haven't been drinking a lot of coffee. I have coffee once a week on Sundays. That's it. I have coffee and I have a coffee roll as my treat for the week.
That's horrible. Anyway, so the first idea of where should we have these discussions, I personally feel like we can have these discussions wherever. Now, obviously, having a discussion on Facebook is going to be different than having a discussion with your professor in their office hours, and that's going to be different than having a discussion at some type of, like, you know, national conference. You know, all these places are just different venues to explore ideas. I don't see a problem with doing that on social media, because that in some ways is kind of the purpose of social media. It's connecting and exchanging ideas. So these are just ideas of a specific type. And to that point, I've had really great discussions on Facebook, you know, in forums, even kind of on Twitter, but usually it's more like it just gives you an idea, then you go off and read it yourself, because, you know, what is it, 140 characters or whatever, doesn't really give you enough time to flesh out an idea. But I think the point of having these discussions is to connect with individuals that may challenge ideas or may present new information. Ultimately, that is what evidence-based practice is. It is not something that tears ideas down, nor is it something that supports ideas. It is simply information gathered. And if we use the information in whatever it is that we practice, if it's nutrition or rehabilitation or strength training or medicine or whatever it is that your field is, then you're taking information and applying it. But research is not the end-all be-all, in the sense that we are not at the point yet in human discovery where we have all the answers. You know, so, and in fact, that'll be a pretty boring place to be, right? If we just know everything, then there's just no more discovery. And that's probably, hopefully, that would never happen. So we use the research to inform our opinions, and opinions are things that are discussed. And I have absolutely and without question had things brought up in social media discussions that have put me in new directions and learned about new areas of research that have absolutely changed the way that I look at things and the way that I approach things. So without social media, I would not be doing the kinds of things that I do today. And so I think that that's valuable. It's not valuable when you've got people that are just arguing, right? They're just, well, I believe this. Well, I believe that. And then it just becomes like this, you know, fight between two people that who can yell the loudest. That's not. Now, good things can come out of that sometimes when you've got people at least trying to put forward reasoning for their beliefs. But if it basically boils down to opinion, then that's not really valuable. But when you have these discussions, even like you referenced, like the discussions that I've had with Brett Jones about the FMS, people have DM'd me, thank you so much for that. It was so informative. I learned so much. You know, that kind of stuff makes it valuable. So because of that, yeah, I think absolutely we can and should have these discussions wherever they take place. But realize that the kinds of discussions you have may change depending on the forum itself, and that's fine. Who cares? That's you know, it's different to speak to someone face-to-face than it is even on the phone or on Skype or something. So I don't think that that should be a reason to say, no, we shouldn't have these discussions here. It's just a matter of recognizing that any discussion that you see between professionals is all boils down to some type of opinion. Hopefully it's informed opinion, and then it's your job to explore those ideas more carefully if it's something that would affect your role as a clinician, as a trainer, or whatever. But I think that they're great, and I absolutely look forward to having them. I think that you can get some really cool information from people when you have such a forum and exchange of ideas.
Let's pause and take a step back just on something that you said. In terms of these discussions and, you know, what people can get out of them, because I think it is, you know, undoubtedly a good resource to have someone like you to be able to spend the time on Facebook and have these discussions with people. But I guess at the end of the day, I don't know, how am I going to put this? At the end of the day, I just don't know how it's a great venue versus something like I think you, again, it was in one of those FMS threads. I said, why don't we just get on Skype or record it? You guys can talk about it. And then we can share it with not just like the, you know, 50 people or 200 people that see it on a feed on Facebook, but everyone can see this, because I think this is a valuable discussion to have. And I think it's also another thing where, people are, I don't know if they're afraid to, you know, rough each other up, you know, call them out specifically. And I don't think that's the right way to do it. But I think there needs to be a better way to do this. And maybe that is something that is worth doing, whether it's on strength of evidence or whatever, but like have Brett on and say like, all right, we have this research in front of us. We have everything that's up until this date. You know, let's talk about this stuff and let's see, you know, the value that we can give to the audience out there. And it would be like, you guys could literally charge for this, because I think it is such a great resource. But I don't know if that might just make more sense instead of just, you know, someone, you know, kind of going back and forth. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think that the more people that you can expose to certain ideas, the better that is for everybody involved. So I absolutely agree with you. People don't like being challenged, right? You know, so a lot of times these discussions come up almost spontaneously because someone challenged an idea or a concept. And a lot of times, you know, unfortunately, these pissing matches occur because people take it personally. Like, oh, you're saying that the FMS doesn't work? Well, then you're saying that the results that I just got didn't happen. You know, this kind of bastardization of what is meant or what is being criticized or analyzed. So I think that that's probably part of it. People, look, we don't want our ideas to be challenged, and there's a fear of maybe being shown to be wrong in a public venue. You know, that's all part of the process, though. You need to have humility in order to be evidence-based, because if evidence comes up that is in contradiction with your beliefs and the evidence is well done and quality evidence, you need to respect that and analyze what you're doing and incorporate that new evidence. But I agree with you. I mean, to have a conversation that reaches you know, what are the numbers on the FitCast? I mean, in a year it could be, you know, in the tens of thousands easily, then that's a better place to have a discussion than on my Facebook that has, you know, like 2,000 people on it, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So, absolutely.
Okay.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that the conversation on Facebook was bad,
but it
is a great opportunity to go further with them. Sure.
Okay. So let's get the FMS stuff out of the way.
Yeah.
Because there has been some stuff that's popped up in the recent months. Can you point out the, I think there was two or three studies that have come out literally in the last like 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you could bring those up real quick and, or even just, no, just like, seriously, just kind of like summarize, like, you know, were they valuable to you and were they valuable to the people out there, or were they literally just, you know, kind of worthless? What can we take away from that stuff?
Right. To me personally, my personal opinion, the most interesting and valuable research has been some of the research that is now looking at the FMS in conjunction with other things. So they're looking at FMS scores as well as the identification of asymmetrical movement or control side to side. There's been some research that's looked at FMS plus things like the star excursion balance test. The researchers are doing are trying to combine things. I think that this is a good direction to head. People think that I'm some type of FMS hater. Nothing could be further from the truth. If I have a usable tool, why wouldn't I want to use it? It doesn't make sense to say, no, I don't like the FMS because. That's not what my point has ever been. My point has been that I don't find it to be clinically reliable. The numbers don't pan out. I don't have population investigations with the type of populations that I work with. So I don't know what a score means for an apparently healthy individual. I don't know what that score is. Is it a 14? It might be. But there have been investigations that have used 16, you know, with firefighters. So I don't know what scoring means. I don't know if scoring means that someone will be more likely to be injured and therefore I should train people that have failed the FMS in a certain way to reduce their potential for being injured. I don't have information that tells me that. So maybe people that are failing the FMS are failing it for a completely different reason than some type of biomechanical issue. And by training them to pass the test, it does absolutely nothing for them in terms of their risk of injury, right? So if I can't adjust the risk of injury, then maybe I can still have information in terms of a pass-fail. But if I can't affect that, then my choices are either, well, I can either sit you on the bench for the season because you might get injured, or I can play you, but you might get injured. It doesn't, in other words, I don't find it to be usable. If we can improve those numbers, I'll be the first in line to pick this stuff up and start using it. Why not? Why wouldn't I? That's valuable information to be able to reliably predict someone's risk of injury. So I would absolutely be all for it. I just don't find it usable right now in a clinical setting.
Gotcha.
The numbers to me are too unreliable. Chris Beardsley did a great review of the FMS recently for his website. What is that? Strength and Conditioning Research, I think.
Yeah.
And he pointed out a lot of these things. We actually spoke about this as well. He's writing a more a paper more suitable for like literature. And it's going through literature review now. So we spoke a little bit about that too. And I thought that his insight was very good, and it mirrors my insight. These are the things that are lacking. If we don't have answers to these things, then I don't feel comfortable using it as a clinician. But this new stuff, I think, is where the FMS needs to go. It's at this point, I don't think that we're going to suddenly find out that the numbers are going to be improved. Like, oops, we were just kidding, and all the numbers are great now, and it's very reliable. So there has to be, in my opinion, something has to be done to augment the FMS in the way that it's done right now. Maybe that means a change in the way that, you know, in the exercises that are chosen. Maybe it means a change in the way of scoring, or maybe it means that you do things in addition that weigh in on this ultimate prediction value. Now, I've seen other things brought up, like movement baselines, but that doesn't make any sense to me. A movement baseline is the way that you move in the beginning of training, but that's specific to the type of training that you're doing. I don't understand using a basically a selected bunch of bodyweight exercises and deciding that that has any relationship to the type of training that I'm going to do. I need to see evidence that that's the case. You know, I can train someone to squat well. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to change the way that they run, right? So my squat would or would not be a good quote-unquote movement baseline. And if I'm using it in this way, I need to understand what that means. What value do I get from having a movement baseline? Is analyzing the specific things that I do not a movement baseline enough? Like, can't I see that, oh, you know what? We started training, you had these problems in your squat, but now we've trained you and your squat is better. Why is that not a movement baseline? Why do I have to go back to an FMS that I don't train? Right. So these are questions that I have, and these are the reasons why I don't support its use at this time. Or these ideas.
Even for general, you know, fitness folk that are just kind of, you know, they just got their CPT or something like that, and they're just starting to train people. Do you think it's a good, right, at least introduction screen for people?
Well, what I think,
just to give them an idea of, like, you know, I think, right, outside of the test, uh-huh, you know, from what I've seen, just the information that they give you on things to kind of look for, not necessarily in the screening process, but,
right,
you know, overall, you know, things to watch out for, you know, huge asymmetries from, like, just introducing, right, people to the concept of asymmetries. They might, right, not even know that, because let's be real, when we look at stuff that the NSCA and NASM is a little bit better at this, but what they put in there for their CPT certifications, there is not a lot in there in terms of assessments.
Right, absolutely.
So I think this is at least something to give them, you know, to get the ball rolling and to, you know, get them to think about this stuff a little bit and on what to look for. Because if they see that, you know, on one side they have a 3 and on the other side they have a 1,
right,
you know, at least it gives them some idea that, okay, something is off here.
Right. Well, the first part of that question is that we're assuming that this means something, and we have to verify that. Now, it may very well, like I said, this new research is looking at asymmetry and is finding similar prediction values as the score that, mm-hmm, you know, under 14. So we'd have to determine that an asymmetry and an asymmetrical finding means something. There is some research that supports this. It's not terribly strong research, but there is some research, but it's done typically in athletes and it's done in strength values, not necessarily movement. Gotcha. So you're looking at, like, hamstring asymmetry strength in soccer players, stuff like that. So if I'm looking for something, if I'm going to evaluate something, I need to understand that it actually has value. Otherwise, okay, I'm just wasting my time. So I that may be the case, but then we still have to understand that, yes, an asymmetrical value identified on the FMS has meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And by correcting this, we will improve some type of quality of the individual, and we don't know that. We absolutely do not know that changing the score means anything.
Gotcha.
So I agree. If we can have that information, then sure. But we don't have that information yet, and it hasn't been provided. And so you could say that it's reasonable to assume that this is the case, but honestly, I don't know that it's reasonable, especially when because when we look at the asymmetry research. Some things, yes, like I said, like, you know, strength differences side to side in soccer players or whatever. But then there are other things like the shoulder positioning and movement do not appear to have any correlation with injury or pain. So it's not a slam dunk in the research. It's a little bit mixed. And therefore, we really have to, when you see that it's not all pointing in one direction, then it becomes a little bit more important to really investigate specific things. If I claim that all asymmetry is bad, that's too broad of a statement and we don't have the ability to make that claim yet. But there may be some things that you can use clinically. So if you know that those strength asymmetries in a population that you train, if I'm a soccer coach, I might be interested in knowing the strength balance in my players, the lower extremity strength balances, because that did seem to correlate with some type of injury. So that's important to me, and I can use that. But if I'm training, you know, general population, I don't really know if asymmetry has as much meaning. By all means, pursue it and change it. That's fine within your training session. But how far do we take that? We don't have those answers yet. So, and there's reason to at least make the argument that too much doing this may actually cause harm. That focusing on these types of things without cause may actually produce harm in a small percentage of our trainer of our clientele. We don't want to do that. So we have to know a little bit better before we make these broad statements. So as far as like, you know, describing how to screen, I would say is I think what you're kind of getting at is really more how to evaluate. Mm-hmm. Because a screen is a specific thing. It's a specific medical tool that we use to give us information about risk ratios in people that we work with. An evaluation just means let's see how you move, your strength, your this, your that, whatever. So yeah, finding out how to evaluate someone's movement is a great thing. If we're using the FMS to do that, I don't, maybe you can.
Okay.
I mean, I guess you can, but then do you need to use the FMS after that fact, right? So if I find out like, oh, okay, these are the things to look at.
I said we were going to do 5 minutes of this. I think, is it, can we play the music, get you off the stage?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, well, if people really want this, we'll do like another super one, and I'll email Brett Jones and see if we can have what are those things called? Like a debate? Is that what it's called?
Oh, the debate squared.
I want to do the presidential one. All right. You have 2 minutes. 2 minutes.
Yeah, man.
Time's up. Nope. Time's up. Man,
and then they keep talking for another minute. Yeah, man. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's like, nope. Candy. He had extra time. Candy. Man, the elections were fun.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go into some questions that we also got. Some from me, some from the audience. The first thing that I wanted to bring up is we always, you know that sleep is important. But, you know, personally, I wanted to ask you, you know, what has there been out there in terms of research that has been showing us that, you know, these are the side effects and of sleep deprivation? And also, you know, what is the optimal amount of sleep? Like, you still have some people saying, you know, six is that you should get at least six. You don't want more than eight. If you get more than eight, then it starts going downhill. Like it's a crazy bell curve.
Right.
You know, what are we looking at in terms of that stuff?
The biggest risk is increased mortality. People that get that don't get enough sleep die sooner than people that do.
Substantially sooner.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the numbers are. It is an increased mortality. Mm-hmm. It's statistically significant, which means that it's not chance. But other than that, I don't know what the clinical significance it is. It may be a number of years, but I'm guessing. I can't remember.
Gotcha.
But it's something. I mean, look, man. I mean, if I can get an extra week, I'd like an extra week. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know about you, but everything is affected. Your reaction times, your performance and strength, your awareness and wakefulness, so your actual ability to think and reason and everything that you can think of is affected when you don't get optimal sleep. So it's really a no-brainer, and the more research that they do, it's just the more that they're finding that this is the case. What's also what I think is interesting for shift workers, which includes myself, because the prince likes to stay up all night. So I just got back from the desert weekend where I was up all night. So I would be a shift worker in that sense. Even if you get the right amount of sleep, shift working seems to do harm to the individual, and that they believe that has to do with the circadian rhythms. So we're meant to sleep when the sun is down, and we're meant to wake up when the sun comes up. And that is how our bodies adjust that circadian rhythm. So when you break that, even if you're getting the right amount of sleep, you're still not getting all the benefits of that sleep. And there's some really interesting research into why they believe sleep does this and what is happening. But I don't think that it's fair to say that we absolutely know what sleep does. But it is very interesting areas of research from the few papers that I've read and articles and stuff. Optimal sleep is 7 to 9 hours, but that's just the average. Most people will require between 7 to 9 hours. There are a few people that require a little bit more. There are a few people that do legitimately require less. You know, if you're getting enough sleep, if you're waking up naturally, you're not tired during the day, you're not needing, you know, lots of coffee or stimulants or whatever to stay awake. So there are people that 5 or 6 hours is absolutely perfectly acceptable for them. But for the majority of people, the assumption is 7 to 9 hours. And then on any individual level, that may or may not be true, but is more likely to be true than not for most people. There was an interesting infographic that I just put up that looked at the at athletes. And there was like 10 or 15 athletes that they gave a range how much sleep that they get in a night. And the only athlete on that list that got fewer than 7 hours was Tiger Woods, actually. He gets like 4 or 5 hours a night. But there were some athletes, there were some swimmers that are up to like 10 hours a night or something like that. No. That was a tennis player. Who did Nadal just beat your man? What's his name?
Federer.
Yeah, he gets like
10, wow, that was a good shot, man.
That was really good. Yeah, really good. So it was just very interesting that, and that's exactly what I just described. If you look at that curve, you've got one person that's way on the outside in one direction. You've got one person, Tiger Woods, that's way on the other end of the spectrum. But then the rest of them are all falling 7, 8, 9 hours a night.
Wow.
Yeah, that's okay. The kitty.
All right. So very interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is interesting. But anything that you can do to – it's not just, and again, it's not just the duration, but it's the quality too. It's that it's a good sound sleep, but it's one of the major things that contribute to just about everything in your life, and we tend to overlook it. And I've been posting a little bit more about that because I do think that it's interesting, but it's also really like it's one of these things where you get questions about like, oh, you know, what hand position should I use in my rows for optimal strength? And it's like, okay, but are you eating, sleeping? You know, like these things are way important. These small details are fine, but let's not put the cart before the horse.
Yeah, and you know, we even see things in terms of like for fat loss clients, like the amount of or the severe increase in hunger just based on lack of sleep is huge. Yep. So if you're like thinking that you're always hungry, you know, you should try getting some more sleep. And it is kind of crazy. I have, you know, a couple of clients who have dealt with sleep issues. One with, you know, sleep apnea, but he has problems with the CPAP machine. But two things that I found has been helpful. One, I keep hammering him, and like I'll text him at 10 o'clock at night because I know he goes to bed at like 10:30, and say, "All right, first off, you've stopped playing PlayStation, right? You've gotten away from like very intense activity, like." And also, I have him do, and we're going to talk about PRI in a little bit, but he has breathing issues. Like he literally does not know how to breathe. Like he just completely breathes through his shoulders. Like I'm sure his scalenes are, you know, jacked up in terms of his breathing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And just literally doing like 5 really good breaths before going to sleep, like laying down, has allowed him to like breathe better at night, not wake up a lot in the middle of the night, and has made a big difference. And I think that's, and also calm down too. Like it just like, it's almost like that meditation thing before you go to bed.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's fantastic advice. And that's,
Let's talk about the PRI stuff. Okay. So, you know, again, a quick plug, but I think literally Body by Bo Online has become like the number one resource for video for a PRI because we've had Michael Mullen come in 3 times. And I forget the name. Oh, God, I'm blanking on the name of the guy that came in before. But we have like, I think, 8 hours of PRI lectures and hands-on stuff now. If you want to check that stuff out, you can go to bodybybo.com. So anyways... with all that stuff, we've been implementing some of it into our programming at MBSC, primarily the breathing stuff, because we find that it does help with our adults, you know, primarily just to breathe, be able to, like, you know, breathe more efficiently so they are not so quickly out of breath or tired and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the PRI material, I was wondering, what have you checked out and what do you think so far?
The only thing that I've really looked at, we had an episode of we were going to do an episode, and I'd like to still do it at some point, but we were going to investigate that, this idea of diaphragmatic breathing and specific claims that probably came out of the, you know, blowing in a balloon study or paper. Actually, it's not a study, but the paper that they had written. looking at diaphragmatic breathing and how it affects biomechanics and things like this, I had something like 50 something papers to read and review and summarize and whatever for this episode. And it was just a beast. I mean, it was just a monster, and it was really killing us to try to get this done. So we sort of scrapped that episode, but I would like to return to it because I think it's a fascinating topic. So it's really the only thing that I know about PRI. I can't really speak on anything else. And you can actually tell me if I'm getting it right or not, because I may be misinterpreting it. But my understanding is that they're looking at diaphragmatic breathing as it relates to core function, as it relates to overall function, biomechanical function of the individual.
Yeah, and also, you know, just helping with proper alignment. And the thing that I've probably gotten the most out of it is and I swear, like, if I'm not really one of those guys that just does something and it makes him feel better. What's the thing that I'm looking for? What's that word called? Placebo effect.
Placebo effect, yeah.
But as I've been doing it, you know, I literally spend maybe 5 minutes, not even five, maybe 4 minutes before I even go into my rolling and stuff like that. And I do the belly breaths, and immediately it wakes me up a little bit. When I, maybe it's because I'm also having a caffeine before I left, but I get woken up. And also like immediately I feel like I can just do those belly breaths and I'm ready to sprint. Like I've been right. Warming up less, just doing the belly breaths, doing less of the dynamic warm-up stuff, and I've been performing better in the weight room, and with like the dynamic stuff that we do, like the ladder drills, right. You know, lateral stuff. So for me personally, it's made a big difference, because today, you know, there are days where I have to, you know, sit and stand at a desk for, you know, 6 hours a day working, and then I go into lift. It's not real. And it's like most people out there. And it for me personally, it's previously I've been feeling like going into the gym has just been a pain in the ass, and it takes so long to warm up. I just feel like garbage all the time. And with now that I've been doing this stuff, like just doing that has made a huge difference in terms of getting ready to lift and to perform in the gym.
I think what's interesting about the breathing stuff, there is no question that breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, and gentle kind of meditative type breathing is beneficial. What is not as clear is whether or not it really has anything to do with biomechanics. Now,
I mean, I was going to say, and also I've run into shoulder problems, and I've torn my pecs a couple times on each side. And this has gotten me back. I swear to God, I have not benched in like 9 months. And because every time I went to go do even push-ups, I had to be careful because I felt like my pec was going to tear again. Because again, I'm so internally rotated, especially on my right side. Doing that, the breathing exercises has completely alleviated that, to the point where I'm dumbbell benching again, like getting back up to 75 pounds, where, you know, it's not like the 100 plus that I was, 100 plus, don't hundies, you know, that I was doing before. But
it's swell, bro.
Yeah, it's just mostly because I'm being cautious, because it is, and it's one of those things that you want to be able to do what you want to do in the gym. Obviously, for us guys, like it really sucked to not be able to bench press. You know me, I mean, if you've listened to this podcast,
this is like your life. Yeah,
that was, I mean, for a long time, like I would just, when I was interning at Cressy's, when we a bench day was like, it was Christmas once a week.
Right,
I got to open up those presents in you know, bench. So to just get this back, and I haven't done anything else differently. It's literally just been this, and nothing else got it better. No soft tissue work, no real activation, like trying to get more external rotation has helped. This stuff worked. And we've seen in our staff a lot of other things clear up too, and people in terms of people with hip issues, shoulder issues. It has made a difference, anecdotally.
Right. And you just open up a can of words, and you're going to hate yourself and then me, because I know how much you love when I get on these things. But my friends at Soma Simple will not allow me to get away with this if I just nod my head in agreement. There's no question that diaphragmatic breathing can absolutely have an effect on what you're describing. And what you're describing is previous experience of injury and pain, and now the alleviation of future pain, right? That's what we just talked about. And we're assuming that
should
there's
a biomechanical. Should I go to the bathroom right now, or are you going to be going for a little bit?
It'll be a while, but kidding. You might actually find it, yeah. So we're assuming that it's biomechanics, and there may very well be biomechanical inputs that affect that. But what we have to understand, and I'm not going to take a long time to do this, I just did an interview about pain. Like, we can put it up in the notes or whatever if people are more interested in that. But pain itself is not specifically from tissue. It's not tissue damage. It's a warning. It's your brain saying something is representing a threat. That threat may be true tissue damage, but it may also just be the risk of tissue damage. And when we talk about risk, risk is an assessment, right? We don't say, oh, I might cut myself with this knife. What we're assessing is the quality of the blade, the sharpness, the proximity to your hand, right? It's not just like a knife across the room. I better not walk near it. I might get hurt. That's silly. But if I'm juggling with a knife, that risk went up because now I'm assessing the potential risk of slipping and the knife cuts me in the arm, right? So the brain is giving you information in terms of producing pain to change your behavior. So if you've had, and that pec tear, how is it diagnosed? Through imaging or?
How is it diagnosed?
Yeah. Did you go to a medical doctor and they imaged and found evidence of tissue tear, or what happened?
No, I felt the muscle tear and then roll up on my
shoulder. It rolled up? Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's pretty good, yeah. So
it wasn't a complete tear. It was a partial tear on all right. the occasions. It was just literally, it's the grossest right. feeling you'll ever feel in your life.
Right. Did you have pain before that instant? Like months before, weeks before?
No, I had maybe the set before.
Okay, so you never felt pain in your shoulders? You never felt pain in your shoulders before?
No, always been good to go. I mean, even overhead has all been great. And back to and now, I mean, like I said, just these past couple of weeks, overhead stuff has been getting a lot better too.
Okay. So what we have is what appears to be – now that's actually quite interesting. If we think about this in terms of pain as being a signal, then we can possibly think of a couple different scenarios. Either for some reason that day something happened and you tore your pec and it was just out of nowhere. But the other way that we can consider is there may have been slight damage done before that event. That's reasonable to consider. You know, unless you went up like 30 pounds on your bench that day, it's kind of odd that that day was the day that you tore without anything happening before, without soreness in the shoulder or whatever. So it's entirely possible that you had actually been doing real true tissue damage before that event, but your brain was deciding that it wasn't a threat. Maybe because of the way that you thought about bench pressing. You're very positive. You love bench pressing. I don't want to give up bench pressing. This isn't a problem. I've got this. I can handle this. I'm strong. So your beliefs may, in fact, have depressed that signal of pain that maybe should have occurred beforehand until the day that you actually tore it to the point where there was physical trauma of true tissue tear, you know, that bubbled that guy up and you couldn't move, you know? That's an interesting perspective. I mean, the other way, I would have expected the other way, that you were having pain and you were ignoring it. But the fact that you had the absence of pain and then a traumatic event is also very interesting, because it still points to this idea that it is not a one, it may not be a one-to-one correlation in your case, but certainly overall between tissue damage and pain. We can have tissue damage without pain. That's like the event of, you know, you find a bruise on your arm and you're like, how did I get that? You have no memory of bumping your arm. You don't remember it, and you didn't have any pain when you bumped your arm, but suddenly you have evidence of true tissue damage. There's also, you know, people that will have evidence that they did tear something or they strained something and they didn't even know that it had happened. There have absolutely been times where you check someone like clinically in physical therapy and you find out that they had torn their ACL in the past and they're have no idea what you're talking about. They don't remember any event that happened. We can also have the event of pain without tissue damage. So this is most well observed in chronic, like low back pain patients. There's nothing physically that can be identified that correlates with their pain, and yet they're having pain symptoms. It can be in the very well-known example of phantom limb pain, when an amputee feels pain or an itch or some type of physical feeling at the end of a limb that has been amputated. That limb no longer exists, and yet they're feeling true pain where that limb should be in their mind. So pain works in conjunction with tissue damage, but it is not a one-to-one, and we can have these types of examples. So if we bring it back to the breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, what diaphragmatic breathing does that we know that it does is it reduces the activity of the central nervous system. It calms us. That's why it's such an integral part of meditation and thoughtfulness and awareness. Breathing is always a part of these things. So it reduces our activity. Pain can be increased or decreased based on our psychological, sociological, historical value assessments. That's what pain is. So again, maybe your brain was looking at some damage. It was getting sensory information from shoulders and pecs, and things are straining or things are slowly beginning to tear. And the brain is assessing the situation, saying, no, this is no big deal. This is not something that I should be threatened for. I'm not worried about this. There will be no pain in this area. And then lo and behold, you tear. So that would be an example of the brain deciding that even though there was true tissue damage, that damage did not represent threat, the same way that you can have that bruise and never feel pain because it's not a threat. How many times have we been bruised before? The brain decides that it's no big deal. So diaphragmatic breathing basically calms the brain. It calms the central nervous system. And when we warm up, we're not only trying to sensitize the neuromuscular system for the activity that we're about to do. You know, if I'm about to bench press, I want to do stuff to prepare my body, prepare the nervous system for the bench pressing. But I also wanted to slow down stuff that would act against this, right? So it's kind of like a double-edged sword. I want to activate some things, but kind of decrease activity in other things. Diaphragmatic breathing can absolutely do that. If I'm tense, if I'm upset, if I'm anxious about something, my performance will suffer. My pain, my pain could increase. It's been shown to increase just based on you know, stress levels. So if I'm decreasing that overall stress level, my performance will probably increase. I don't want to be too decreased because then I'm just lethargic. But diaphragmatic breathing doesn't do that. So I cannot speak to the biomechanical inputs that have been attributed to diaphragmatic breathing. Certainly, they may indeed happen. Whether or not that's valuable is the assessment of the central nervous system. Is any input valuable? So it's not a slam dunk. That's why stuff like the training the transversus abdominis, which I just posted up on Facebook, actually, an article that basically showed that there's no correlation with low back pain in terms of reducing symptoms. Biomechanically, it's there. You know, the research that's been done biomechanically shows stuff about the transversus abdominis, but because it's only a biomechanical assessment, it is disregarding the psychological and sociological inputs and the historical frame of reference that the brain uses in any assessment of the body. So why is this stuff valuable? Well, I think it's valuable because what it's telling you, if you're using the diaphragmatic breathing, continue. Because if it's working for you, no matter what the reason is, it is working. It could be placebo, but it's also very possible it's working on a different way. So maybe it's not biomechanics, but maybe it's looking at the central nervous system activity. But by knowing that, what else could we do to possibly affect that system, right? And it changes our approach from talking about mechanics and I'm a little bit off, I'm a little bit shifted, this, that, or the other thing, which may or may not be influencing your activity, your sensation, your response. But we can identify something that absolutely is, which is the overall system. So now if I say, well, gee, I don't want to be overstimulated, right? I don't want to be worried about any of these biomechanical influencers, because if I've been told that chest breathing is bad for me, then anytime the brain is assessing the body, it's now also referring back to this claim that chest breathing is bad. And I've just increased the possibility of real performance decrease or pain because the brain is already sensitized to the idea that chest breathing is bad, whether or not it's actually true, right? So encourage diaphragmatic breathing, not by saying this will protect you biomechanically, but by saying that this will produce positive things. In other words, we've taken something that is a generally negative statement, don't do this, and rather we encourage better behaviors by saying this is beneficial to us. But we don't say that the opposite is bad. We just introduce something and say that it is good. And then for all the things that relate to that idea of sensitization of the central nervous system and of using our neuromuscular system it to our benefit, we can think of lots of different things to do in the gym in terms of, you know, what is our recovery like, what is our sleep like, going back to that question, what is our diet like, and using all these things in combination to produce better results for our clients.
I was trying to scare you for a second that I actually left. Dude, that's super interesting stuff. And again, I think it just raises more questions.
Right. It does. And see, this is why I love
I wanted to give the people like a goodie bag to go home with. Let's give them a goodie bag to go home with today.
Goodie bag to go home with is that
our I got some more questions.
Okay.
Oh, but no, I don't know if you want to wrap that up though.
Well, I think that the overall statement there is that we have to be careful with our claims. I've always said this, but we have no idea.
No one has any clue what the hell we're doing. Right. We're just throwing crap against the wall.
But you know what? The thing is that, so in this case, I'll give you a really, it's a fun example.
We're just trying our best, educated guesses on all this stuff.
Listen, this is a fun story. I love this story. I recently got married. Thank you for your congratulations, you son of a bitch.
Dude, you wanted me to do it on the show? I did like a month ago.
So Marianne, Kane, and I got married on
You already
New
have
Year's.
Three kids. You got the dog and a...
Yeah. No, we got more than that because she's got three cats already. So we've Holy got four crap. Cats and a dog now. Yeah, man. Yeah, man. So...
Hope you got some like bulk kitty litter discount there in Saudi Arabia.
Seriously, Costco, here we come.
Yeah,
Costco,
but do you have like a pet? Do you have like a place where you can go get some pet goods?
Yeah, there are here. It's really expensive. Usually, honestly, I just buy stuff when we're traveling. And
get
I
it for the ounce. You know, buy 5 ounces of getting that kitty litter.
Kitty nip. 5 ounces, man. That's not even enough to fill like a cup.
I know, but I'm saying you got to buy it like drugs. You got to buy it like Coke.
So anyway, so we go on our honeymoon, right? We went to Mauritius Island, which is in the Indian Ocean. It is absolutely gorgeous there. And we went to the Four Seasons there. So you couldn't ask for a more incredible vacation honeymoon. I mean, we just absolutely loved it. One night, Mauritius, like most of the islands around that area, it's like it'll rain for like 20 minutes in any given day. You know what I mean? So it's just like, oh, look, it's a nice little rain shower. And then you go off on your day. So it was raining one night, and she and I are in, we have it's like a private, like bungalow kind of thing. You can look at the pictures on my Facebook. The place is just gorgeous, but we're sitting in our private bungalow, and, you know, we've got nice, like classical music playing, and we're talking, you know, we're newly married, and we're talking about love and romance and how wonderful everything is. And we're all so happy, you know, so we are just happier than anything. And it happens to be raining out. And we hear a thump outside. Honestly, like, what's a thump in a rainstorm? It's like a coconut falling from the tree or a branch hitting the wall or something like that, right? It's nothing. Neither of us said anything to each other. We didn't even like look at each other weird. We just kept on with the conversation. But a minute or two later, I'm looking at her and I'm like, you heard that bump, right? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, are you nervous? And she goes, yeah. Did you lock the back door? Because we had a front door and then we had a back door to like an outside shower kind of thing. So I was like, I don't know. And now I'm getting nervous too because I don't want to be killed by the axe murderer that's obviously standing outside the door. So I go to check the door and it wasn't locked. And I lock it. And now I check the closet. And now I check the bathroom. And completely absurd. We're two rational people. We're grown adults. And we are freaking out because there was a thump outside. And then I go to check the front door. And we had the curtains pulled. And I promise you, I'm looking for like feet underneath the curtains. I like kind of like punched at the door before I opened the curtains because I'm scared out of my life. I become that 8-year-old child going downstairs in the basement, right? The dark basement. Now the boogeyman's going to kill me. We're two grown adults and we were freaked out and paranoid because of a thump that we heard outside during a storm. Immediately you're thinking like Jason is coming out of the ocean. Like we, our villa was like right on the ocean. So we just, our backyard, we walk into the backyard and then there's the ocean. And I'm just, I've got these images of like Jason in a hockey mask coming out of the ocean to kill us. Why did we freak out like this? We freaked out because one, it was dark. So the dark is bad. Every horror movie takes place at night in a storm. So now we have images of, you know, Jason coming out of the ocean and horror movies and people getting murdered. But we also had the event 2 or 3 months earlier when we found, when we booked the trip to Mauritius and that we're going to stay in the Four Seasons. Marianne posted it on Facebook. And out of the, you know, 50 or 60 comments and congratulations and looks beautiful, one person mentioned that something like 5 years ago, there was a honeymooner that was murdered in Mauritius. It is literally like one of two murders that have ever taken place on this island in its history. It is one of the safest places in the world. I looked it up after that he said this, and Marianne and I both like just like scoffed at it, thought it was so silly to even mention, and we never thought of it again. But that night, when we hear an inexplicable bump, our mind immediately went to that event. We both did. Immediately thought, oh, someone died in Mauritius once. That is an example of sensitization. That is what pain is. When our brain assesses a scenario, it looks at all of the possible explanations for what has happened. It looks for all of its events and its history and its beliefs and things that it knows to be true or not true. And in our minds, we freaked out over something so silly and stupid. And the next morning, I mean, we were cracking up. We met the general manager randomly, and I was telling him we were laughing. But that night, it was real. That was real fear. It's like 2 8-year-old children playing in the dark. And that's what happens to our brain when we have pain in the absence of tissue damage or minor tissue damage that results in major instances of pain. This is chronic pain. This is this event that I have a bad back. So now we think about all the language that we hear during the day, and we think about all the ways that our trainers are saying, don't breathe like that, you're going to hurt yourself. Don't squat like that, you're going to hurt yourself. Don't, pain, pain, pain. How many times can you just think of reading that on Facebook or wherever? And when your brain is assessing the situation of your body, it's going to recall these things. Even if you consciously do not remember these things, the brain may have kind of put that away for safekeeping. So our language affects our performance. It affects our feeling of pain, the experience of pain, and we need to get better at keeping our clients safe and not just making them believe that everything in the world can harm them, every movement can harm them, every weight can harm them, and if we're not perfect, we're going to injure ourselves because ultimately the brain may believe that and will produce the exact situation that we think that we're protecting them against.
Maybe we should wrap on that.
Oh, but there were some other good questions.
No, what I'm saying is we can come back and we can do a part two.
Okay.
Like we did with Lee. And this way, this is like, all right, we got the ball rolling for you guys out there. Let's get some follow-up questions and we'll continue to work on the questions that we got last time. And we'll be having John back on next week whenever you get back in like a week, right?
Yeah, we're going on a ski trip, so I'll be in Switzerland for a week.
Rough life.
I know. That's a bitch.
All right, so we'll be back next week. We'll come back with John. So if you do have more questions, throw them to questions@thefitcast.com, or you can hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. And as always, please, if you can, subscribe on iTunes, all that good stuff. And try not to get too angry with John or myself for having John on.
Seriously.
Like, he's just he's trying to do what he thinks is the right thing, you know? He's not trying to hurt anyone. All right, thanks for listening, everyone. Thank you, John. Have a great week.